Welcome to A Better Lifestyle. I am your host, Richard, and I will be with you throughout this journey. This show is here to empower individuals to do more in life professionally. You will find a variety of topics that will help you to be more productive and more successful. So join me and the professionals from different industries as we bring education and knowledge for more success. Okay, let's do this. My name is Richard L'Esperance. I go by the name of my man, Richard. Welcome to A Better Lifestyle. Today, we're going to talk about finance, and I have the pleasure to have Brian Kuhr. I forgot to ask you how to pronounce your name.
Kaderna.
Okay. Yeah. So I have Brian with me here. So he's in the finance industry, so he's been there for a long time. He's got a lot of wisdom and a lot of insights to share with us. So please, Brian, tell everybody who you are, a little bit about yourself, your story, and we'll get started.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Richard. And so I guess kind of my background, I started as a financial advisor in 2008. It was perfect timing, you know, coming out of the Great Recession. And been doing it ever since. You know, I got attracted to the career because I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I think the three things that really led me was being an entrepreneur, wanting to be a teacher or a coach, and also just a passion for economics. And kind of when you roll all three of those together, you get being an independent financial advisor, where I manage my own practice. I'm teaching and coaching people all day, every day about their money. And I get to study economics every day, which is something I've always found fascinating. So I kind of lucked into it out of an internship. And then, you know, here we are, I guess, 16 years later, kind of doing the same thing. And, you know, it's been a fun ride.
So how do you work with clients that come to you, whether it's on a personal level or on a business level?
Sure. So I would say my clientele, where I'm at right now in my career, a couple of things to give you a little background, I guess. It's almost like I have four separate businesses in a sense. I have a disability insurance business, a life insurance business, assets under management, you know, just a good old investing, stocks, ETFs, wealth management, and then like a fixed annuity side. So while they all blend together, you know, some clients might check all four boxes, some might just come to me for one. There are almost four different revenue streams I have as a firm. And if you look at my clients, I would say that probably about 75 to 80% right now are physicians. And it started early in my career. I got in with teaching hospitals. I was doing financial literacy talks to, you know, medical residents, medical fellows, excuse me, a lot of the doctors that were getting started. And then really just got entrenched in that space. So now I speak at hospitals all around the tri-state and offer referral. I have physicians, you know, all across all 50 states that I work with. So that's where a lot of them come from, or from seminars. With the doctors in particular, we do start more protection first, focusing on insurance. And then as they get going in their careers and they have families and so forth, that's usually when we expand to looking at the full financial plan and kind of get a little bit more involved.
So what was your relationship with money back when you were young and until now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I was young, there was no relationship. You know, I grew up in, I guess you would say, middle class. You know, we were a pretty blue collar town in Wanamassa that I grew up in. My mom was a paralegal. My dad works for the Army. And I don't remember a lot of financial conversations. They would often say, you know, we're comfortable. That was kind of the word we always heard. If my brother or I ever asked a question, they said, you know, we're not rich. Don't worry. We're not poor. You know, we're comfortable. We're going to be okay. But I know that we were also very frugal. You know, we didn't do crazy things. We did, you know, camping trips. You know, my parents were smart with the money, and especially early on, we did have to kind of, you know, really pinch pennies, I guess you would say, to kind of get by as a young family. So it was good because you knew maybe there was financial pressure there, but you never saw it. And our parents kind of sheltered us from that by just being smart with their money, even though they never had a financial advisor. And then when I got in high school and, you know, started learning about what's a stock, you know, how do you make money to make money? And they always said, oh, you got to be rich to do that. And if I said, oh, you know, I want to invest in Disney or whatever, at that time, you know, this was before kind of the internet took over. And they said, oh, you got to get a stockbroker and you got to have tens of thousands of dollars. You know, that's just for rich people. And so it was kind of like that whole world of finance they were not exposed to, and nor was I. So it was interesting to kind of see, like, as life went on and then I got into the business, I was almost my parents' first exposure to the financial industry. And so we kind of like learned it together. And then I realized it's not just for rich people. And, you know, it's this enormous industry that's growing by leaps and bounds. So early on, there was no relationship with money. And now it's a, you know, a constant relationship.
Talk to us about the nine domains of economics.
Sure. Yeah. So in my new book, which came out last year, called What Should I Do With My Money? I essentially break it down into nine domains. And the first one is population. And these are actually the chapters of the book. So the first one's population. I'm talking about how we're getting to be more and more of a crowded planet, you know, about 8 billion people, you know, here today. And that number has been kind of doubling over the past century a number of times, which is pretty wild. And some of the population dynamics from country to country and how that affects economics. So that's one. And then we get into entitlements. Then we get into education. Then we talk about technology, environment, war, religion, economic philosophy. So all these kind of monster issues, and we take them from the macro down to the micro to see what that actually does to money. And then I conclude with the chapter on personal, you know, financial literacy. So it's like, now that we understand kind of how the world works, how money moves in and out of everything, now we get to make those personal decisions so that we get in control of our own money and then can start kind of affecting the change that we want. And so essentially that's the roadmap of my book.
Can you give us a little something for each of the nine of them? You give something for the first one. Can you give a little something for the other ones so people can
Certainly. Yeah. So kind of as far as like just a little teaser, you know, we spoke a little on population, how, and I think, you know, people see, okay, the world hasn't grown at all, but our population, if you look at a chart on the history of mankind, it kind of just putters along and then it just spikes like straight up. And that's where we are today. And if you dig a little further, you'll see here in America, especially in Japan and China, some other developed nations, this aging issue where we're not having as many babies as we used to, and people are living a lot longer than they used to. And so if you look at the pendulum, kind of how it's tilting, you know, we're having more and more baby boomers living longer and longer. And that feeds right into the chapter on entitlements. And our biggest entitlements, you know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. How do we actually fund these programs that started out very small, but now they're the biggest line item on the U.S. budget? And then what does that affect economically? And we go into education, how we learn everything, and the kind of the model we have today towards higher education, which again is on the backbone of federal funding. And that's kind of what's propped up a bit of a student loan crisis, frankly, that we're facing. And so it's unique. You have people on the back end saying, hey, protect my Social Security. I can't watch my Medicare premiums go up. Then you have young folks on the beginning end saying, I can't afford to even get started or to buy a house because I'm just, you know, strangled by college debt. And then you have the government in between, like, all right, where do we look? How do we help everybody? And then that feeds into some of those other things of, you know, tech is kind of like our silver bullet that has always helped us kind of innovate and grow the economy when we do have issues. And then environment, you know, is a huge one. A lot of the tech is dependent on environment, on these natural resources, on, you know, these rare earth minerals and metals, you know, for microchips and everything. And then I get into philosophy, capitalism, socialism. We talk about global conflict, you know, how that affects everything, which we're witnessing all this right now. And then religion, I think that was a curveball that a lot of folks were like, how did that find its way into a finance book? But if you look at the oldest ideologies and philosophies people cling to, a lot of them are faith-based. And you look at a lot of the governments around the world, they're guided by faith and their disagreements on faith. We've seen that as old as time, you know, that has kind of had, you know, monster issues on a global level. So I think those are some of the teasers. And then finance, that's just my bread and butter that we conclude with.
So let's talk about financial literacy, which is a big thing. How can someone like be more financially literate?
Sure. Yeah. So my first answer would be go check out my book. What should I do with my money? And then what I always kind of tell people, and this is I'll try and give a short answer to a very large question, is I like to follow a four-step process. And so I tell clients, number one is protection first. All right. We've got to make sure that come hell or high water, you, your family, your money, your business are secure. You know, we have contingency plans. Number two is building liquidity. We need to have emergency funds. We need to have cash so we can take advantage of opportunities as life goes on. Number three is managing debt, particularly toxic debt, like credit cards and things like that, high interest debt that can get out of control. And then number four is growth or wealth management. And so I follow those four steps because I think a lot of people, they think, all right, a financial advisor, I'm going to call Brian and we're going to go invest in Nvidia, or I'm going to buy Bitcoin and I'm going to try and double my money. And they have kind of these sexy ideas of how much they'll make. And that's all well and good. We certainly do that type of work. But if we don't have a strong foundation to stand on, then it's like we're playing with fire there, where one misstep, you know, the whole financial plan can start to crumble. And so it's imperative we take that order. And I think that's what I spend a lot of my time talking with clients about, is like, let's worry about the blocking and tackling first, and then we'll really get into the more intricate, fun parts of finance.
So how was your journey as you built your practice as an entrepreneur?
So it's been fun. It's one of those things that, you know, I would say that I'm so happy I did it. I'm so happy I'm where I'm at right now, but I wouldn't want to do it again. And I think a lot of business owners will empathize with that those early days of, you know, coming out of college and saying, all right, I'm learning all this finance stuff. I'm getting all these licenses. I'm studying my butt off. But now who do I go talk to? And early on, I mean, it was everything from, you know, a lot of cold calling. It was going to a lot of networking events, just trying to meet people in the area, just constantly go, 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 go to just meet people and build a brand. And that was hard work and with very little pay, you know, when you're getting started. So those first few years, it's difficult. I mean, you're working your tail off and you ask yourself a lot of times, like, what's the point? Is this even going to work? Is it sustainable? And then as you start to build that momentum and you do the right things and your name gets out there, then things start to come back to you. And then you can really have more flexibility to say, all right, now I'm going to pursue what I want. I'm going to do the podcast. I'm going to write the books. I'm going to target market a little more. And that's when it gets fun. So that's kind of been my journey in a nutshell.
What would you say is the mistakes that entrepreneurs and business owners make with in regards to their business, in regards to finance?
So, I mean, there's a number of pitfalls in entrepreneurship that people can kind of fall prey to. I would say one that's pretty common is not staying liquid. I think that's usually the big trap you find, is the business owner might get overconfident at certain times. They might either feel some financial pressure or see some sort of expansion or advertising or what have you that they really want to go after. And so to alleviate either side, financial pressure or to go chase and grow, they then lean on debt lots of times. And so when you take on debt, it obviously debt is crucial. I mean, that is what can help us grow. And it's almost like the steroid that can get us bigger and better. But it's dangerous. It's a double-edged sword, where if we're not able to monitor it and keep it in check, and if we're losing liquidity on the other side, that's when we start to go out on thin ice. And I think when you get in those situations where it's like, okay, I need this to go right, and if this happens, then it's all good. When I start to hear that from business owners, I get a little worried, where I'm like, okay, you just threw me like four or five ifs, and we need all of them. And if they don't happen, it sounds like we've already exhausted the reserves and we already tapped the credit line, and now we're in a dicey situation. Usually when I see a business that's struggling, that's it. They did not have enough liquidity. They didn't have enough cash. It kind of led to more debt, and now they're sometimes digging a deeper hole to get out of. So I think liquidity is so important for a business owner.
So, what are the several ways for businesses to manage cash flow? Are there other ways?
Yeah, and that's kind of the million-dollar question right there is, you might have the best ideas in the world, you might have fantastic work ethic, but like without the money, it's like, where do you go? And so I think, I guess two things that I would say to people out there is, one, don't jump too soon, and then don't bite off more than you could chew. All right, so early on, you might have to say, all right, I got to keep building up kind of my cash cushion until I feel comfortable that I'm ready to take this leap. I think that's important, so not diving in too soon. And then I think the other thing, obviously, being very smart with your budgeting, always kind of calculating a plan B with each step. Things like that are critical. If you're taking on investors or you're taking on debt, I think it's important to look at, how are you going to pay them? Are you hoping on kind of prayers and ifs that you'll get there? Or do you know you have a baseline revenue stream or income or customer that can at least take care of those so they're satisfied, even if you have to go on a tough stretch for a couple months personally? I think those are the big things, is being very strict with the budget, very realistic on the inflows and the outflows. And lots of times today in kind of this gig economy, I'll tell people, hey, if you're a teacher and you started this side business that you're opening a snack stand, don't totally let go of being a teacher yet. Maybe if we can do both for a little while until you say, hey, this thing's on its feet, it's doing pretty well, then you could take kind of cut the cord and move on to that next step. But I think being methodical about it is important.
What about tax planning strategies?
So yeah, tax planning. I know we're covering a lot of ground here. And I will preface, I'm not an accountant. I'm not a CPA. Obviously, a lot of the financial planning I do all has a tax slant to it that we're very aware of. But I just want to kind of put that disclosure there. People should speak with their CPAs or tax attorneys. With that said, in regards to tax planning, I guess a general message I have for people is to see the big picture. And what I mean by that is, lots of times when a client comes to me, they've been conditioned, often from their accountant, that they hear defer, defer, defer. I want to take every tax deduction possible, and I want to defer taxes as much as possible. All right, I've heard that kind of mantra a million times. And when they do that, when they're saying, all right, any excess money, it's going in my 401k plan, or I'm opening a traditional IRA and contributing there. And then I want to get these write-offs, and I want to do all these different things. And then what they're trying to do is lower their reportable income this year to say, okay, I got a tax refund, and that makes me feel good. But a lot of times we're kicking the can down the road. And I think then once we fast forward 20 or 30 years and we're in retirement, if we have a lot of pre-tax assets, that can be a difficult situation to unwind when we're actually living on it. So a lot of the things I talk with clients about is, just like we're diversifying investments and doing all that, we also want to diversify your tax bills. And so you may pay Uncle Sam now and be home free later, or you might kind of kick the can and get a break today, but then owe the piper way down the road. You want to understand and kind of hedge your bets there, so that eventually, when you want to use your money, whether it's in 10 years or in 30 years, we have what we call tax arbitrage, which means you're in a position where you can say, okay, I'm going to pull from this bucket or that bucket, as opposed to saying, oh man, every dollar I ever earned is in this 401k that's 100% pre-tax. And then if rates go up through the roof, now we're really in a tough spot. So I think those are some conversations I have pretty frequently.
One of the main thing is lack of patience when we talk about financing and trying to build wealth. So what would you say about that? Like some people, like there's always like something like the flavor of the month and all that. So people are trying to find quick ways to get money. So what would you have to say about that?
Sure. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head on probably what's one of the biggest issues I face as an advisor is when somebody comes in my office, they always heard that. They heard something on the latest podcast, on a blog that they read. Before they came in the office, they were watching, you know, CNBC or something. They got a stock tip. And I think, you know, when you, I always say, you know, it's okay to learn that stuff and to kind of keep up with everything. But you don't want your plan to kind of blow with the wind. You know, I always say you got to agree that north is north, but have a plan that's flexible and adaptable. And so we can kind of work with these things. But when you do have that flavor of the month, everybody and their brother wants to hop on board. You know, that sometimes can be a trap. And so I think when you said patience, that is key. And I've told so many people, I'm like, if you can take just a patient, slow and steady approach, and we can assure you that you'll hit your goals, would you like that? And a lot of people say yes. And I'm like, well, here's what we have to do. Do you want to do this? And then they kind of have the hesitation because they're like, well, what if I skip this and this? And then what if we got to go spend more money or have some more fun? And then I'll cover it up because I'll try and do this over here, or maybe we'll make a lot more. And that's where it's like, okay, you just threw a bunch of maybes in the scenario, and that's what you're going to be, you know, kind of presented with if you don't want to be patient and take kind of more of the tried and true path. So time is a great asset. If you have it, you know, use it to your advantage. But that assumes that you can be patient and kind of let your money do the work.
You have another situation when the market goes down. So when you have a bear market, people are panicking. So they're wondering if they should take out their money or change strategy. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, and that's kind of that herd mentality. You know, Warren Buffett, who I've always looked up to him, legendary investor, he always said that you want to be fearful when others are greedy. And you want to be greedy when others are fearful. And that takes a lot of kind of guts to buck the trend and say, okay, you're all saying that. I'm going to go over here and do this. You know, just in life, you know, if we're the kid on the playground that says, okay, you guys don't want to do this thing. I don't think it's right. I'm going to go over here. That's hard to do. And it's the same thing in investing. And we often say in the industry, the stock market seems to be the only place when things go on sale, people don't want to buy it. You know, if we go into the grocery store and we see this cereal or this coffee or whatever we like is discounted, we're all over it. But when we look at the stock market and, you know, a couple of years ago, it goes down by 25%. It's like the natural reaction is to run the other way. When if we look at it, the whole concept of investing, if we do it right, is to buy low and sell high. But it's almost like that human nature sometimes forces us to do the opposite. And that's that herd mentality that you always have to kind of keep it at bay.
So what would you say, I'm going to wrap it up. What would you say like your last words in regards to everything we talked about, investing and all that?
Yeah. So I think this was good, Richard, because he asked a lot of questions that kind of hit on key points that I make. And I guess what I would reiterate from a financial literacy standpoint is be patient, protection first, okay? Don't try and do anything, you know, too crazy. And then I always tell people you want to try and stay the course, okay? And that doesn't mean that your plans and your life aren't going to change over time, but you want to be able to say, okay, this is the strategy I'm coming up with, and then I'm going to stick to it. If I'm a conservative person by nature, I'm going to do the absolute best I can with a conservative approach. If I'm an aggressive person, I'm going to do the best I can leveraging what I can from an aggressive standpoint. The pitfall you see all the time in finance is when they start jumping. Like you said, they say, hey, I'm conservative, but my friends over here made all this money in the market. Let me get in. And then the market gets a little choppy and they say, oh my gosh, I can't do this. Let me go back out. once they start doing that, there is no plan. All they are is just kind of this emotional whirlwind. So I think you need to be calm. You know, I think that's where a rational investor really does well, is when they're calm and they're in control. And the whole reason I wrote my book, What Should I Do With My Money, is to try and teach people how the economy works. So I think once they kind of understand what's going on out there, then they're like, all right, I get it. I see how the game is played. I see how kind of the world's spinning. And now I can be calm about it and I can make informed decisions.
I know. I think this is not your first book. I think you had other books before. Can you tell us about the other books?
Yeah, sure. So my first book that kind of got me on the stage, if you will, was called Millennial Millionaire. That came out, I want to say 2015, 2016, somewhere around there, was Millennial Millionaire. That was almost like part memoir as a financial advisor, like some of my experiences, but also financial literacy. So that was really cool. And then in between, during coronavirus, I kind of took a hiatus and I wrote a young adult fantasy novel called Anorak. And if you can't remember Anorak, it's actually just Corona spelt backwards. And that was a lot of fun to kind of do that, get into like a whole nother space that I was working in. And then a lot of people wanted a sequel to Millennial Millionaire. I was fortunate enough to end up teaming up with McGraw-Hill, and they took the rights to my next book, which was What Should I Do With My Money? And that really blended some of the finance wealth conversation with economics and kind of tie it all together. And so that's my latest book.
So where can people find the book?
Yep. Yeah. So What Should I Do With My Money? The subtitle is Economic Insights to Build Wealth Amid Chaos. It's available paperback, audiobook, or Kindle, and it's wherever books are sold. There's Barnes & Noble, Amazon. You'll be able to find it.
And where can people find you on social media and the internet?
Sure. So folks can follow me. I have a podcast called The Kaderna Podcast, where I dive into a lot of this type of conversation. Have some really cool guests on there. And then on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, just B Kaderna. So it's B-K-U-D-E-R-N-A. If you type Kaderna anywhere, I should probably pop right up.
All right. Thanks, Brian, for being here. It was nice meeting you and talking to you. I hope people found value in that conversation. I know I did. So it was very nice. So on that note, thank you everybody for taking the time to listen to the podcast. Welcome to A Better Lifestyle. My name is Richard Lesperance, and I go by the name of my man Richard. And I was with Brian Kaderna. And we'll see you on the next episode, everybody. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. If this is your first time listening to the podcast and you like it, please don't forget to subscribe at the end. Thank you and see you next time.